dedicated to each and every one of you who appreciate a great glass of wine. You know what I mean?
It's Monday. Let's raise a glass to the beginning of another week. It's time to unscrew, uncork, or saber a bottle, and let's begin exploring the wine glass. Today, I sit down with David Parker, founder and CEO of Benchmark Wine Group, located in Napa Valley. Benchmark Wine Group is the leading source of fine and rare wine for wine retailers, restaurants, and collectors around the world. We discuss how to begin collecting wine, some suggestions for not only varietals, but regions that will age well and provide the best bang for your buck if you add them to your collection. David also shares his knowledge of the best conditions to store wine to allow them to age properly and how all wines worthy of collecting do not need to be hundreds of dollars. Hey everybody, I'm Lori Budd, a UC Davis winemaking program, Sommelier Service, Champagne Specialist, and WSET Level 2 graduate. You can find Exploring the Wine Glass on all the socials, as well as your favorite podcast catchers. If you haven't subscribed yet, now's the perfect time to swipe, subscribe, rate, and review. I promise I'll never tell you what to drink, but I'll always share what's in my glass. No. I want to give a big shout out to Ted Ross for leaving this 5-star review. Something new in every glass. I'm really enjoying listening to these. Lori is so at ease and does a great job engaging with her guests. I found out something new in every glass. I mean, in every podcast. With a couple more months of winter and who the heck knows about COVID, I'm hoping I will be able to catch up quickly. Thank you, Ted, for listening and for leaving this fantastic review. This truly is the best way to show support of the podcast and to help let other wine lovers find Exploring the Wine Glass. Hey, everybody. Welcome to another episode of Allure of the Pour, sponsored by Dracena Wines. I am your host, Lori, and I am a WSET Level 2 graduate, a champagne specialist, a UC Davis winemaking program graduate, and co-owner of Dracena Wines and Paso Robles. Today, we are talking something different today, and I'm pretty excited about it because I get so many questions from people of, should I buy this wine? Should I not buy this wine? Why is this wine so expensive? Why is this wine not? Is this a good vintage? Is this not a good vintage? And we're going to get these answers today from David Parker, who is the CEO and owner of Benchmark Wine Group. So welcome, David.
Thank you, Laurie. Happy to be here.
So my first question is, you know, it's always origin. So just tell me about yourself and how did you get into wine? What made wine be the thing you want to spend your life doing?
Well, I got my degree in engineering and computer science, so I was a tech guy, and I moved from the East Coast out to California to work in the Silicon Valley. And out west here, they have a lot of free wine back in those days if you went up and down the valley. So I figured I'd better learn about wine since I was in California. And worked for several companies, one of which I co-founded, and that became pretty successful. And sort of at that same time, went from kind of dreaming, wouldn't it be nice to own a vineyard, to saying, well, hey, I could at least make a down payment on one. And so in 1987, I bought a little piece of land in Geyserville, California, in the Alexander Valley, and had a bunch of really old vines on it, Carignan, Petite Syrah, back in those days weren't worth anything, little Zinfandel. We planted it over to Cabernet because nobody wanted to pay anything for the wine from those old vines, which kind of in hindsight's a shame because they're a bit of a treasure. But so with growing Cabernet and Zinfandel in Alexander Valley, later on decided I liked Pinot Noir and met Bert Williams of Williams Sellium and asked him if I were going to buy some Pinot Noir land where I ought to go. And he said the Eola Hills of Oregon. And so not Russian River, he said Eola Hills of Oregon. So I went up there, found a piece of land and bought that. And Domain Druin is right behind it now, but back in the day, there was no one around. And so about that same time, got pinged to move up here to Oregon by a high-tech company, came up here, moved my family up, and a few years later, had an option to get into the wine business in a serious way, not just grow the vines. Started a really the first continual internet wine auction company, Brentwood Wine, from my property on Brentwood Drive in Westland, Oregon. And one thing led to another, and decided that this is what I wanted to do for my second career. So a few years later, founded Benchmark as a wholesale retailer in Napa Valley. And along the way, bought an information company. We published the Wine Market Journal, which has basically gives you a complete list of all the collectible wines and every auction trade that they've had since 1997. So that becomes everybody's reference for the right price to pay and what you're going to get for your wine someday when you decide to sell some of it.
So when you had your vineyards, when you first started the vineyard, were you making wine for yourself? Were you selling fruit? Were you, you know, what did you start with?
Yeah, we started by selling fruit. Okay. We sold fruit to the Benzigers and the Mandavis. And so those are
nothing like starting with the little guys, you know, we'll just go right to the all, you know, to the all-stars.
Yeah, well, we were very lucky. They came to us through our vineyard manager. And so they're both great families to work with. And so we did that for a number of years. And then in 2001, decided to hold aside a little bit of fruit and put it under the Parker Family Vineyards label. And we did that for about 3 years. And then by that time, these companies had gotten fairly large, and so had our family. So we decided that couldn't make them all work at the same time. So back 2005, 2006, we sold the properties, but to good homes. Pete Sagacio took a Geyserville property. And if you've ever heard of Duke's family, it's on Amity Hill, that was our Oregon property.
Wow. Very nice. Very nice. So, you know, you are truly a master of a lot of different fields. You come into the tech and you're making positive moves in the tech, and then you go into the wine world and all positives coming in. And that's wonderful. And so when did you go from, okay, I'm selling my vineyard, but I still love wine, but there's a difference between liking wine or even loving wine and then, you know, becoming a collector of wine. So when did you start collecting wine? When would you consider yourself a collector?
Yes. Although the relationships with Mandavi had a little bonus, which is that as a grower for them, we could buy any of their wines for a very substantial discount. Same with Benziger. So with great wines like Mandavi Reserve, 1994 vintage, Opus 1, some of the Benziger imagery, artistry labelings, sort of started collecting those first because of those relationships, and it grew. You know, once you start collecting wine, it's a lifelong hobby. And the travels through the Napa Valley, the Sonoma County, you know, you also tend to pick up wines and sort of souvenirs, and so those always, you know, become a treasured part of a collection too.
Do you remember what your first wine was that you would say was a collection? You decided, I'm going to collect this. I'm going to hold on to this. Do you remember what that first wine was?
Yeah, I told you the Robert Mandavi Cabernet Reserve 1994, and it got some huge score from, you know, the major reviewers. It's a great vintage in California. And I overbought that. You know, every time I could go buy, you know, a case, I'd go buy a case. And it started to started to stack up. I also recall that I was married in 1988. So I bought a bottle of 1988 Mouton Rothschild, which at the time had been given a perfect 100 points by one of the reviewers, and a bottle of 1988 Salon Champagne. So those became treasures for our 25th anniversary. So those were the founding pieces of my cellar.
That's incredible. Oof, that's incredible. I just personally, we just celebrated our 25th anniversary, and we were married in 95, and I went all over the place. Actually ended up purchasing it from you, but went all over trying to find a 1995 wine that was going to be drinking well now, because, you know, I wasn't really collecting it. I was purchasing it that you've already collected it for me. I find it incredible. I was born in 68. I would love to find a 68 and just, you know, a wine that is still tasting amazing now, and do that. And also to find a 70 for my husband. But
well, that was a good vintage for port, if you like okay. Ports, but we can probably find something for you.
All right. So now, with this statistic that like 95% of purchased wine is consumed within 48 hours, probably 24 hours. Okay. What would you say is the difference between a wine connoisseur, a wine lover versus a wine collector? What teeters you over to say, okay, I'm going to be this patient, and I'm going to wait because I'm going to reap the rewards of patience?
Well, I think what tips you over is when you have your first or your second or your third really high quality wine that's been well aged, and you have it at that right moment with the right food, the right company, the right mood. And you'll hear people talk about their epiphany wine. You know, the clouds open up and beams of light come down from heaven, and you hear the angels sing, and everything in the room kind of fades away compared to what's in your glass, and then you're hooked.
Yeah. And I think every wine lover does have their epiphany wine. And it's my epiphany wine for just getting into wine, not necessarily I'm going to start collecting wine, but was actually a Ferrari Carano Chardonnay. That was the first wine that I was like, oh, this is actually really, really good. And as much as I loved that Chardonnay back then, my palate has changed, and it's not my palate anymore. But the first wine probably that got me hooked on Bordeaux and collecting was actually Clerc Bayon. So we were in Bordeaux, and they were our host for my blog that won the award. They were our host. And when I tasted that wine, I was like, oh my goodness. And then, you know, all of the other places that we went to go taste, it was just like one was just, you know, as good or better than the next or whatever. But the Clerc Bayon is really, really the one that, like, that's the one I really get all giddy about when I can pre-purchase, and then I get even giddier when it comes, when it gets delivered.
Yeah, no, that's an excellent wine. You know, the super seconds, the third growths, you know, those hit the sweet spot between affordability, relatively speaking, right, and drinkability. You know, right, they might be a tiny notch below the first growths, but the price is half or a third the price. So
right.
Very good ones to start collections with, actually.
So now my next question is the whole going forward with the OTBN, you know, open that bottle night, whatever. How does that correspond to collecting wine, right? They're telling you don't wait for a special occasion, and then you're trying to collect wines. So is there a balance? Is it not even related at all? What do you, your
Well, yeah, I think when you're collecting, one of the things that's important to do is buy several bottles. If you've liked it in the tasting room, or it's the kind of wine you just know you're going to like, buy a case. Why not splurge? And then when you have those tasting nights, you can pull one of these out and say, well, I haven't tasted this in a couple or 3 years. I wonder what it's like. Share it with your friends or just have it by yourself, but then say, okay, now this is getting better, but maybe I should wait for another 3 years. Or, boy, this is just at the right spot right now. Now I'm going to drink the rest of this over the next year or so. I mean, that's part of the enjoyment of collecting, is sort of seeing that wine evolve and figuring out what the right moment is for you. It might be different for somebody else. And then knowing you still have a whole bunch of enjoyment left in that case.
So if somebody wants to become a wine collector, what would be your first recommendation, your first step? How do you tip your toe in there without getting overwhelmed? Because when you look at, and this is like a positive of benchmark, there's so much there. You have such a collection that we can purchase, that if somebody is new to wanting to collect, it's like super overload of how much you can do. So how can somebody start, dip their toe into, your portfolio and feel secure, okay, I'm going to start with this. Do I start with one? Do I start with 10? What would you recommend to start a collection?
Well, yeah, I think the first question you want to ask yourself is, why are you collecting? Okay, you might be collecting just to have a good variety of ready to drink wines available to match with food, to take as gifts. If you have guests that come over that like certain things. And so that's a very legitimate reason to start a collection. Likewise, you may be wanting to put wines away for your children or your anniversaries, special events, and you might know what vintages you want, but perhaps not exactly the wine. So understanding what it is you're collecting for is sort of how you start. Then if you're on Benchmark's site, as we've got, last I looked, about 13,000 different wines and, quite a few bottles of each of those, but we have all kinds of filter functions. So you can pick the vintage, you can pick the region that you might like, you can pick your price range, you can pick a critic score range, and you don't necessarily want to pick 100-point wines. They're much more expensive. You get some very great, good drinking wines in the lower 90s too. So you do all of those things and you'll probably find it's a manageable number. You'll then see a number of different producers, and you can pick a producer maybe that you're familiar with, and then you can bore down, okay, this producer, what are all the wines that are available from this producer in those other parameters that I selected? And you might find three or four, and you go, aha, I've got to get this one, and maybe I'll get this other vintage too and compare them. However you want to work it. You can play around, buy a few bottles now, see how you like that and continue. But again, it all starts with knowing why you're collecting, knowing what you like, invest in the education. And then if you're going to buy very much, you have to have a very good storage facility. That's key too. That doesn't have to be expensive. It can be a locker that you put in your garage. It could be a nice appliance that goes in your kitchen. You can get space at a commercial storage facility, or you can splurge and turn a spare bedroom or the underside of your house into a wine cellar.
And I think you had brought up the topic of you don't want to necessarily go all in a 100-point wine, that it doesn't have to be that. And I think a lot of people have the concept wrong, so that if you're a wine collector, then everyone that's in your cellar is multi-hundred dollar bottles of wine or more so than that. And so what can you tell them about, the pricing of the wines? When's the best time to buy? How do you know, all right, I'm going to pull the trigger?
Well, you made a comment a little earlier that I thought was very much to the point, which is 98% of all wine is consumed within 48 hours of being bought. Well, you know what? 98% of the wine in the world is meant to be drunk in the first 48 hours after you bring it back. It's not built to age. In fact, it's only about 250 brands of all the tens of thousands of brands out there where they're really made to age. And we've all heard of the first growths or all the classified growths of Bordeaux. You know, we've heard of some of the famous Burgundies. And now there's a tremendous amount of great value coming out of Italy, out of the Rhone, out of even Argentina, and Australia and other regions. What do they have in common? They've got balance, they have structure, they have acid, they have tannins, not overwhelming, but in proportion, and a lot of other things that go into them in terms of pure crops. They're made to age. So you want to learn what those wines are. We have one here that I thought would be the epitome of what you could consider collecting right now. Okay, so this is the Tignanello 2017. This is the current release. I don't know if you've got some in your glass there.
I do. So here it is, beautiful color.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And I think quite a compelling aroma. You can tell it's not a Cabernet kind of aroma.
No, it's got some meatiness to it. There is no, I think the cab, you think that green herbaceous, and it is not, it's meat. It's got some spice in it. It's dark cherry. It's beautiful. It's got a wonderful nose. It's beautiful.
Yeah. And it's clean. It's got good acid, but it's got, you know, that tannin grip in the back. So this is the kind of wine, if you're starting a collection and you're going to put it away for years, you're not going to go wrong. This is the average price, I think, of this in the market right now is about 143. Benchmark's about 125. Okay. But Tignanello is arguably the first Super Tuscan out there. They did an experimental production in 1971, Piero Antonori. And Sassicaia, they had done an experimental bottling. He was a partner in that in 1968. So that was really the first time in Tuscany they started putting Cabernet in with the Sangiovese, which at the time still violates the DOC laws. As far as the other Italians were concerned, it was heresy. But now a whole class has grown up out of this. And these wines are still made to age and be beautiful. And if you go visit that property, they've got these special white stones laid out in between the rows to reflect the light up off of the ground and ripen the grapes wholly. That's why you're not getting that green taste. And what's interesting about this property is they make another one. This is about 80% Sangiovese, about 15% Cab Sauvignon, 5% Cab Franc. The ratios change a little bit every year. But they make another wine that you may have heard of in the same property that's called Salaya. Mm-hmm. And Salaya is just exactly the opposite. It's 80%, 85% Cabernet Sauvignon, Cab Franc. 10, 15, maybe up to 20% Sangiovese. So it's like the mirror image of this wine. And it sells for twice as much. And, you know, a lot of people will confuse that with a California cab. Well, why would you spend twice as much? It's wonderful wine, for sure. But why would you buy a California wine from Italy when you can buy an Italian wine with a lot of that same character for less? This has got a wonderful reputation for aging. If you're following the royal family, this is This is Meghan Markle's favorite. She named her blog after it. You have a lot of stories that go with it. So when you pour it for somebody, A, you don't feel like you're breaking the bank and pouring a $500 bottle of wine or $300. B, you can put it away for 20, 30 years. It'll probably go up in value a bit. C, there's plenty of stories to go with it. And D, it goes better with a Florence bistecca beefsteak than a California cab.
And now a word from our sponsor. Did you know that Dracena Wines has a wine club? We named it the Chalk Club. Draco is on our label, but Vegas was getting a bit jealous, so we decided he deserved to be our wine club spokesdog. In Las Vegas, betting chalk means that you are betting on all of the favorites, and we're gambling that once you taste our wines, we will become one of your favorite wineries. The club is simple, yet a bit different than most. We don't ask for a lot of commitment like others do. Choose between three tiers. The Sweet 16, where you'll receive three bottles twice a year and get 25% off all orders. Sign up for the Elite 8 and get 30% off all orders and receive four bottles twice a year. Or make it to the Final Four and receive six bottles twice a year, as well as receiving 35% off all purchases. All tiers receive discounted shipping, are customizable, and are eligible for unlimited referral bonuses. Add $15 to your bank for each person you refer. Head to www.dracenawines.com or the link in the show notes to find out all the Chalk Club has to offer and to sign up. We've stocked the odds so that you can get our award-winning wines without breaking the bank. You brought up a lot of things that are important for aging, that it needs to have that tannic structure and it needs to have the acid to hold up over the years. Now, how does, you said that they have a history of aging, of standing up to age very well. How does one go about getting that? At some point they weren't aging, right? So like, at what point is it deemed they have a history of aging well? Is that question making sense?
Yes. Okay. Yes, and then that's a very good point. It's one thing to get a really high score your first year, right? Or like some of the Australian wines that one of the famous reviewers discovered and gave extremely high points to for a lot of years. People discovered that they didn't age all that well in the cellar. So in my opinion, the answer is at least 20 years, because you've got to see, not only does it seem like it's going to age well from the basic components, you know, that we're getting out of this young wine, but does it in fact work? And so I mentioned there's about 250 brands that are really collectible. They all have that kind of history. You know, some of them have, you know, well over 100 years of history. But it's when you're tasting the 20 and the 30-year-old wines, if they're, you know, Cabernet-based, if they're heavier reds, that you can start to say, yep, this is a great collectible. Then you start tasting three or four vintages in a row. And some people will say if it's a great wine in a weaker vintage, then it really is a great wine.
Absolutely.
Chateau Latour is a perfect example.
Right.
It's, DRC Latache is a perfect example, if you can afford that anymore.
Right.
They're extremely good wines, even in less
or vintages. Right. Yeah. The saying is anybody can make a good wine in a great vintage, but it's those few that can make a great wine in a poor vintage.
Mm-hmm.
So now going back to this is a 2017. So it's an infant. And you know, one of the things that people always ask is, okay, so I'm collecting this wine, I'm putting it in my cellar. Now I know we're buying more than one bottle, but when do you recommend? So for this one, like, when would you recommend thinking about opening it? And then we're drinking it as an infant. I mean, I'm going to open this and I'm going to drink this weekend, but we're going to decant it to, you know, so can you talk about things that people can do to know maybe when to try it for the first time and then what things they can do if they are drinking an infant.
Sure. Well, there's two answers to that. One, you can trust in the people that make a living at it. You can, the reviewers will all indicate a drinking window, so you can go by that, or you can go by your own palate. Drink one young. This is one of the reasons to buy a case. Now, you know, I think a lot of the characteristics that you described are what I'd look for in an ageable wine. You know, complexity already, you know, good acid, of course, tannin in balance with the fruit, not overwhelming. These are all good signs of aging. I think one of the things that works to our benefit is winemakers have figured out how to make a wine that will age, be approachable young. You're probably familiar with tannin chains. This is what comes from the oak and also the stems and the seeds. And they're molecules that are very long. And when the wine is young, it kind of blocks the flavor. And then over time, those break down into short chain tannins and it smooths out, which is one of the delights of aging wine. Well, there are now winemaking methods where they can start that process going, so those chains are relatively short in the younger wine. It still allows them to age very well, but it allows them to be approachable at a young age too. And the Italians have actually been doing that longer than anybody, with a lot of their barrel aging in neutral oak when everybody else has got it on stainless steel or has put it in the bottle already. That lets a little bit more oxygen in very, very limited quantities, starts those chains breaking down. Another reason why I picked this wine, it drinks well young. It drinks well in 10 years. It drinks well in 20 years. It's not really a bad time to open this wine.
Now, this is, even being the infant that it is, this is so enjoyable right now. And, it, you know, when you add it to some food, you know, this is stellar right now. But it's got that backbone. And the thing that I always look for is, and you had mentioned it's all balance. So if I'm tasting a wine and all I'm getting is tannin, I'm not so sure that's one I'm going to go, you know, go for, because I think that like this has fruit, you know, you've got the primary characteristics in it. It's got secondary and it's got the tertiary is going to come. Right. But if you're already tasting, if all you're tasting is tannin, then I don't think it's in balance. And if all you can taste is fruit and there's no body, there's no tannic structure, there's no acid, then it might taste great now, but it's not going to last. It's going to lose it. It's going to lose itself as the years go by. Do you agree with that?
I agree with you. I think that there's some variation depending on varietal. Okay. I would say Pinot Noir, for instance, can be approachable young and can age, you know, extraordinarily long time, periods of time. Now, if you're going to drink a Nebbiolo done in the Barolo style, you probably want to put it away for quite a long time.
Right.
On the other hand, if you just jump over to the next set of villages and you're in Barbaresco, same varietal, but will be more approachable. Their winemaking style is different. Their vines have been grown in slightly different climate and soils. So I think it varies, but I think more and more, most of the modern winemakers are figuring out how to make their wines approachable young, because the purchase decisions are happening when they're young.
Right.
And, you know, they have to make the cash flow. So it's now a good combination of both, in my opinion.
So you mentioned a few varieties. What would you, when somebody is looking to collect wine, are there certain varieties that you are like are more susceptible to being a collector's piece versus others? I guess we can do the other way. Are there wine varieties that you're like, all right, that's just not ever meant to be a collectible? So however you want to approach it.
Overly oaked Chardonnay is the answer to the second question.
that was like tossing you a melon to hit out of the park there. Yeah.
Yeah, that was a softball. Yeah. But I was initially going to be almost equally flippant and say, well, reds are for collecting and whites are for drinking. But that's not perfectly true. And Chardonnay as made by the Burgundians can be one of the great long aging wines. I would say that there's some of that going on in Oregon also. I think there's some fantastic Chardonnays that are going to be great collectibles. And there's some great ones that come out of California too, but they do some special things. In general, you want to collect the reds because it's harder to damage reds if you're not storing them absolutely perfectly. You want to store them absolutely perfectly. 55 degrees, 70-ish percent relative humidity, not more humid or the labels will get moldy, not less humid or the corks will dry out. I think the clear varietals that have a long track record are, of course, the Bordeaux varietals, Cabernet and Merlot mostly. And no, Merlot is not a bad wine. In fact, it's a fantastic wine. Chateau Petrus, one of the most expensive wines in the world, and Chateau Le Pin, which is even more expensive, are mostly Merlot. Then the Burgundian varietals have been the new darlings of collectors and have really seen huge appreciation. Bordeaux's, first growth Bordeaux's have had their run for 150 years. The Burgundies are much more recent. They've gone up by over a factor of three and a half, mm-hmm. just in the last 12, 14 years. So fantastic collectible. Nebbiolo is one of my personal favorites.
Love Nebbiolo.
Barolo and Barbaresco. I mean, my favorite Barolo right now is a 1968.
Hey.
Yeah, 64 is great also, 61. So they can clearly age. And then the Rhone varietals. I think whether you like Syrah with a little Grenache in it, which would be the Northern Rhone, or Grenache with a little Syrah in it, which would be the Southern Rhone, Chateau Neuf de Pape. Those all have incredible characteristics. I like Riojas.
Seem to be coming up more now. And mm-hmm. they seem to be, I don't want to say proving themselves, because I think they're wonderful and they've been wonderful, but you hear more of Riojas in terms of collecting and aging. More recently in the past few years.
Spain has really, really come up, and the Tempranillo grape, like the Nebbiolo grape and the Pinot Noir grape, develops a tremendous amount of complexity over time. Certainly Bordeaux and Merlot and Grenache and Syrah do too, but in a different way. Mm-hmm. And then you've got both the Rioja area and the Ribera Duero areas, and those wines have the complexity, have the excitement to be the kind of thing you want to put away. Another area that people are just becoming aware of is Sicily, especially from Mount Etna. And there's fantastic whites, there's fantastic reds that come from there, fantastic soils. You can find a spot that's just the right altitude. At least until Mount Etna does its thing again. But we'll hope that that's a while out.
Well, wait.
But yeah. And now, a lot of the Malbecs coming out of Argentina are just unbelievable. And Chile's got some great wines too. So half the excitement, and let's not forget Australia, the Shiraz, the Syrahs. But that's half the reason to collect is to learn about these things.
Regions.
Every bottle could be, an aha bottle or, another epiphany wine. You're always hunting for that.
So with these regions, again, going back, because I think the term collecting, wine collector, has thought of, again, you know, you have these, you know, this person who, and it's incorrect, but you have wine collector, the person is snooty, they have all this money, they don't know what to do with this, so they're just buying all this wine that they're just putting away to show off. And that's incorrect. And so at Benchmark, they can go in and there's a wide range of prices that you offer. But if somebody wants to get in and kind of a sneak attack to collecting, what region do you think is probably the biggest bang for the buck in today's, you know, on your site or in today's world? What biggest bang for buck?
Well, that's an ever-changing question, right? Because I just mentioned how much Burgundies have gone up in value.
Right.
Burgundies used to be where an awful lot of the excitement was. You know, when they went up by a factor of 3.5, the guys that had them were exciting.
Yeah,
they weren't drinking them as much. Now they're selling them. I think another reason I picked this wine, I think part of the answer is in your glass. I think there's tremendous excitement throughout Italy, you know, from Tuscany, where this came from, into the Piedmont, where Barolo and Barbaresco is, down to Sicily, and everywhere in between. Somebody told me that Italy has got a larger portion of its land planted to grapes than any other country in the world. I'm not sure, you know, if that's exactly true, especially if you take some of the little tiny countries, but it's pretty close. And so they have both the experience, the range, and the prices are with a few exceptions, are not crazy. And they're appreciating quite quickly right now, if we look at the market. The other area, interestingly enough, is back in California or the West Coast. For a long time, all the, you know, the so-called cult cabs sort of monopolized everybody's time, and people to some degree lost sight of the classic producers, you know, the ones that go back decades and decades, and they're still being produced, and they've certainly got the winemaking expertise in the land, but they were not quite in everybody's spotlight. I think they're back now. And if you look, you can find very reasonably priced California wines, 20 or 30 years old, and they're exceptional. You know, not quite that old coming out of Washington State or Oregon yet, but you know, there's certainly a history of winemaking there that goes back, you know, at least into the 70s, and that's long enough to age well. But I can almost pick any country in the world and say there's excitement here. Go to Portugal, you know, you may not like ports, but drink some of the dry wines. Those are exciting. Drink some of the whites out of Spain. Those are exciting. I don't know if they have a history of aging yet, but taste everything. Variety's the, you know, the spice of life. But having said that, 60% of the collectible wines are maybe 70 are Bordeaux, Burgundy, California cab. And then everything else is that last 20, 25%. But that's growing. The everything else is growing.
It's growing.
Yeah.
And now we have vintage charts, right? They've done the studies and the vintage charts. How reliable do you feel those vintage charts are? I mean, and do they, how direct of a relationship is it to, if they say, you know, like, okay, so 16 is supposed to be a stellar vintage for like so many areas, right? So is that going to directly correlate to how much more this is going to cost if you want to collect it? And should I be buying it now so that I'm saving money down the road?
Okay, well, it's two questions.
Yes.
Three questions, actually. Let me see if I can get all three of them. So how reliable are the vintage charts? You know, I think that's like if you look at stocks, somebody saying this category of stocks, whether it's, you know, utilities or retailers or healthcare or whatever, are primed to do well. not to say that every one of them is going to be good, right? It's sort of a general guideline. And you can kind of verify that by comparing the vintage charts from different reviewers. You'll find, relatively speaking, similar agreement. And, you know, it's got to ripen fully without being too hot, you know, virtually anywhere to be a good vintage. But there are going to be people that make mistakes in good vintages, and because there's so many different components, both in the vineyard and in the winery, or do very well in what are thought of as the weaker vintages. So they're always going to be, and sometimes that's where bargains are. An example, 1961, okay? Palmer first growth, I mean, Margaux first growth didn't do very well. Palmer, a third growth, did phenomenally, and a 61 Palmer is one of the great collectibles of the world. Palmers are always, you know, a third the price of Margaux's, except in 61. So you've got to get to know the wines, in my opinion. I think you can judge from a value standpoint or appreciation standpoint based on the reputation of the producer plus the reputation of the vintage, and then look at the scores too. I hate to say it all depends on a few people's palates and what number on a 100-point scale they give a wine, but they take a lot of pride in being relatively correct, and an awful lot of people, you know, when they're making purchase decisions, follow that guidance. So, you know, would I ever buy a wine that was 90 points and believe it's going to appreciate in value? I'd have to know the specifics of the producer pretty darn well, you know. I'd have to understand why it was given on the low end of a collectible score. I mean, you're usually looking for something like 93, 94 points or up to sort of be a confirmation that this is probably going to be a solid wine if you put it away.
And so part of collecting is, you know, having fun, legitimately fun, just I'm going to buy this, I'm going to buy this, I'm going to buy this. But there's, I guess if you're going planning to buy wine for you not to consume, but to have a collection that you ultimately have a collection that could then potentially give you money back as an investment. What makes a balanced collection? Or are most people selling their collection single bottle? Well, not single bottle, but you know what I mean? Like this bottle, or is it better to sell as a collection? So.
Yeah, that's a good question. And we're probably the country's largest buyer of private wine collections. So we're always thinking about this. We prefer, and we're very happy when we see a mixed collection, number of different regions, producers, and vintages. We view that as a well-balanced collection. And what we're thinking about is, what was the person's intent in putting this collection together? We're usually happier if we can kind of see through to this person put this collection together to reflect their personality and their broad interest in wine. Of course, that makes it very interesting when we can offer that out to our customers in one of our daily offerings. There's a wide variety of things to choose. And you can almost see the personality of the collector is reflected in the wines that are there. Now, having said that, the people that are collecting as investments, they tend to collect a few cases each, solid cases. They will leave them if they're European, if they're in wooden cases, they'll leave them in the wooden boxes. But quite often they'll even leave them in the cardboard boxes if that's the way they're packaged. The least disturbance possible would be a philosophy there. It's certainly much easier to handle solid cases. And they have a little extra value. Somebody will pay, usually you expect to pay maybe 5% more for a solid case in the box, okay, than 12 loose bottles. Not much, but a little bit. And you've got to be careful if you're buying for investment, to keep the bottles in as close to mint condition as possible. Even scratches, stains, any of those things on the labels or on the capsules, among other things. There's a lot of other things that we look at, but those will reduce the value of the wine. So again, if they're in cases, that carries a little extra value for the person that knows enough about wine to truly be buying for investment. And that's a very tiny number of people.
Right.
I think you should collect for enjoyment first.
My husband always says one of my prize non-wine possessions is I have a baseball that is signed by every 86 Met.
Yeah.
That thing is probably worth a lot of money. And I keep saying to my husband, this is a lot of money. This is a lot of money. And he's like, who are you kidding? You're never going to sell it. So it's worth nothing, you know? So I, you know, that's true. There's probably very few people who are really purchasing it and then saying, yes, I've got this. Okay, I'm going to sell it now. You know, unfortunately, going back to the open that bottle night, you probably, you know, collectors who have passed away without being able to enjoy that wine. And so that goes back to proper storage. So as benchmark, if I've got a collection and I want to sell you my collection, what do I need to prove to you in order for you to know, yeah, you're gonna put Benchmark's name onto my collection?
Yeah, that's a very good question. So where we can, if it's a large collection, we will tend to go and inspect it. And we're looking at your general condition of bottles, and I can describe what we look for in a minute. And we're looking for the location. Now, we also have a large number of commercial storage facilities that are asked by the people at store wine in there, where can I go? And they'll refer them. And we know those storage locations. Quite often, if we can't take a trip out, we'll do a video inspection where just via FaceTime or Zoom, we're looking at bottles. And the purpose there is not to replace an in-person inspection, but to get a general feel for how well were these bottles stored. By looking at a number of them, you get a good idea in a hurry. What we do to really make sure that every bottle that we take and we sell, how do we assure that is doing a physical inspection. I have another bottle here, and since we opened our Tignanello's, I'll use this other one. And you know, you can tell my lighting is pretty bad here. It's hard to see. But things that we're looking for, first, we're looking for no stains on the label, perfectly clean label. We are looking for a perfectly square cork. This isn't bulging out. This isn't sucked in. Okay, those both indicate temperature changes. Okay. We're looking for a fill, unless it's about 30-year-old or older, that fill should still be up in the neck. By about 30 years, it might be right at base neck. If it's a 50 or a 70-year-old wine, there's some room to be down a little bit from the base of the neck. But if it's down any further, that bottle has been in an environment where the temperature has been changing. We also put some thumb pressure on the cork. It better not move. If it scooches down even a couple millimeters, that's a sign that the cork is shrunk. Now, by looking at every wine in the collection, we pretty much understand the conditions under which the collection was put together and stored. And we also will get purchase records if, and that's something else you should do if you're investing for, or you're buying for investment, save all your purchase records, the provenance. Sourcing, you need to either source from somebody that really takes the care in acquiring the wine and stands behind each bottle, which we do, or you should be buying right from the source at release. Those are the two best ways, the two best provenance to assure that you're not buying something that already might be poorly stored. And you know, we move hundreds of thousands of bottles a year. We stand behind every bottle. I can count the number of bottles I get back in a quarter, you know, on the fingers of one or two hands. And in most cases, those are just people drinking a wine that they've never had before and not understanding the characteristics. You know, they know California Cab, they drink a Beaucastel. Oh, what's that gamey character? Well, it must be something wrong with the bottle. No, that's definitive for that wine, right? So those are things you look at. Those are things you want to make sure that you take good care of. Temperature, absolute temperature in your cellar isn't quite as important as stability of temperature. I talked about the fill. Well, the reason it goes down is if it's in an environment where temperature is changing just a few degrees every day or a few more degrees over the course of a year, that's going to make the wine expand and contract every year. And when you pull the cork out, you're going to find one of those mushy corks that soak the whole way with wine. They're going to, or the other thing you don't want is too dry where that cork shrinks. Mm-hmm. You'll get that same staining all the way around. And that's not as good as pulling a cork and just seeing the bottom millimeter, you know, stained red. That's a sign of a perfectly stored bottle.
So I don't know if you saw the news, I think it was last week, but it actually might have been earlier this week, of the person who was, COVID has really, really hit me hard. And I have this bottle of Petrus and I'm going to sell it on Craigslist. And he's like, I'm taking a big hit on this. So I'm going to stand up and I'm going to say, don't do it. Craigslist is probably not the best place to be doing that, where you can see how much effort Benchmark puts into making sure that what you're purchasing is quality and has been held at a positive environment. And I think that is, we talk about collecting wine and you want it to last a long time. And, you know, keeping the temperature a little bit higher than optimal is better than the up and downs. But you can tell those things when you're looking at it. And that's what Benchmark is doing for you. So, right, you need to purchase, if you're collecting, don't go cheap because this person on Craigslist has the name of a wine, right? You want to make sure that it's being controlled properly and tested properly. Now, at Benchmark, you're purchasing wines directly from the wineries themselves, from the co-ops and all that, but then you're also purchasing from collectors. When somebody, if I come onto Benchmark and I'm looking at your portfolio, am I able to tell the difference? And I honestly think that at Benchmark, it's really not that big of a difference because you are so, horrible word, you're so anal about making sure that everything is pristine. Can they tell, is there a way that they can tell the difference if it's purchased from a collector or from the winery?
I'm going to take all those questions because they're all really good ones.
I'm good at just giving them all out, right?
Right. Okay. So number one, buying on Craigslist, don't do it. It's against the law. You really don't want to be doing that. And they do, but there are busts. So there was a auction house that took over for eBay, allowing private party to private party auctioning, which is illegal in all 50 states, as I was saying, 51 states, including DC. And the FBI busted them and they asked for all the records of all the people that had bought and sold wine. And not only were all the sellers being asked, do you have a license? And if you lie to the FBI, that makes things even worse. But then they had the IRS come in and make sure that they had claimed all of this ill-gotten gain. So it was a bad situation for everybody. So you don't want to do it. I mean, there are stories of people that have advertised in papers or Craigslist, and the guy that buys it from you pulls out a badge right after he buys it from you. So no, you want to buy from a licensed retailer. You want, or a winery. Even restaurants now in this COVID era have the right to sell you bottles, and they're all general well monitored all the way through. And if you're going to sell, there's only a very few companies that have the correct licensing, and they'll tell you that, and they'll show you what that is to sell to them. And then the other option is auction houses on both the buy and the sell side, licensed auction houses. And they're great, and you can save some money there compared to a retailer a little bit. But in general, it's caveat emptor for the condition of the bottles there. And quite often, many of them are very reputable, and they will, you know, if you find a bad bottle or two, they'll make good on it, but they're not standing behind that, doing that every single time, because they don't necessarily track the history of the wine like we do.
Right. I thought that whole Craigslist thing was hysterical. I'm thinking, who's doing that? And I was like, oh, I think he's related to the prince in Nigeria who's going to send you $2 million if you give him your bank account number, you know?
Well, that's the other problem with buying from two other problems. You don't know if it's been well stored. And I said, you don't have to store it exactly at 55. If you store it a little cooler, it's going to take longer to age. If you store it in the upper 50s, it'll age a little quicker. You shouldn't store it any higher than that. But if you store it in the 70s, like somebody might, you know, leaving it in their air-conditioned house, that's almost the most insidious, because if it's steady temperature, you're not going to see, there's not going to be any visible signs, but then you're going to taste it years later and it'll have no flavor to it. And then the final thing is there have been history of counterfeiting, some very, very famous stories you might be familiar with. Mm-hmm. So how did, the greatest wine counterfeiter in the country sell his wine? Among other things, he sold a lot of it private party to private party. So every reason in the world to stay away from that.
And there are, there's people who are paid to help recognize counterfeit bottles, correct? You see them in the thing. Are they just doing that by history, knowing exactly what to look for? Labels have giving tells or something like that? Like, how would you be able to know when you're looking, you go in and you're like, no, I'm not going to buy this bottle, it's doubtful or whatever. What are you looking for?
Yes. So I'll take the second question first. We have a team that's very good. We have a large library of known counterfeits. It's famous that the 1982 Chateau Petrus, there's a lot more sold every year in Las Vegas than was ever made. That's sort of the standing joke in the industry. And there are certain, but there's a lot of different wines at the very high end of the market, most especially. And they're pretty well known in terms throughout the industry in terms of what to look for. And we have all of that categorized. The other way is, if when in doubt, we have a library of lots of bottles from the same producer, quite often the same vintage even. If we're unsure about a bottle, we can compare it either to a bottle that we actually have from another source. There's large label libraries that are out there too, so we can look at that. There are a lot of tricks. You have the Tignanello there, right?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. There's a crest on the Tignanello. Right. You rub your finger on it, okay? That would be pretty hard to fake. You'd have to get a whole glass foundry to make you bottles with that logo on it. Now, if you look on the side of the capsule, if you can see there, you've got a 3D sticker on there, right? See
that? Right.
You see the metallic sticker and a little barcode there. These are all more recent elements of making wines harder to counterfeit. But then there are a lot of simple things. If you run your finger up and down that label, you're going to notice it's raised. That's not just laser printed on a flat piece of paper. That's raised. And you can take an eye loop, a jeweler's loop, and you can look down at any of these logos. This is printed. This is not
coming off of a laser printer. So this will not be pixelated. You would not see little tiny dots if you looked at that with a loop, which is what you would see if it was done on a laser printer. But this is lithograph, and it's all smooth. So those are just a few of the tricks, but we know most of them. But there are people that are certified. There's one gentleman that is probably the nation's expert at authenticating wines, and we work very closely with him. He's a partner of ours. And so if we've got questions about something very esoteric, he's our first person to go to. And the wineries themselves, whether they're in Europe or in the United States, they want to make sure there's nothing non-authentic going around. And so they field inquiries too. And that's how this counterfeiter was busted. He started selling wines that had vintages before that winery started to even make those wines. Yeah. You've probably read the book and watched the movie. Sour Grapes is a great movie on Netflix if you want to see the story. But
got a little too greedy and didn't do enough research.
That's right. That's right. Got a little too self-confident, I suppose.
Right. Yeah. Right. So if somebody wants to find their way to Benchmark to start their collection, what is your website? I know you have a newsletter type thing where you send out, specials of this day or that day. So can you talk about how they can sign up for that and how they can follow where you are and know what great deals to buy?
Okay. Yes. Our website is www.benchmarkwine, all run together, benchmarkwine.com. And right there, when you first land on that site, if you want, it'll ask you if you'd like to sign up for the newsletter. You can go in and you can say what newsletter you'd like to be on, because we have one for all our new collections that come in, and we're getting in new collections every day. So you can sign almost every day, and you can sign up for that, or you can sign up for either regional specific. If you only like California cabs, let's say, or you only like Italian wines, you can sign up for special groups just to get those. Or if you don't want something hitting your email box, every day, you can sign up for a once a week summary of what we've done, or you can just visit the site. You don't have to sign up for the mailing list, but signing up for the mailing list is a great way to see everything that we do. The team does a great job of making it very easy to scan through a whole lot of wine, because every day we have a whole lot coming in to find exactly what you're looking for.
And can you just talk a little bit about your Raid Your Cellar program that you do? Because I love it, and I think that it's extremely educational, and it's free. So,
well, and it's coming on in 55 minutes. that's what this bottle is waiting for, actually.
Okay.
But yes, Raid Your Cellar is not quite virtual tasting, a virtual tasting and participation and education. And we have different formats, different weeks. We had a professional basketball player and baseball player on last week, which you might have seen.
Usually they're hosted. I spoke to him. we followed him a lot. We lived in Memphis when he was playing in Memphis. So
it was fascinating. And as you know, most of them are hosted by usually a master sommelier. We've had MWs, we've had sommeliers at other levels. Sometimes we'll do a joint tasting where it will be theme-based and you just raid your own cellar. And we had one with Champagne with the entire board of directors for the United Sommelier Foundation, which is a charity that we support among several others. So we'll rotate around. Sometimes we have a particular winery that comes on. We're having Colgan Cellars coming up fairly soon. Vine Hill Ranch is tonight. So great way to either learn about a cellar that you don't know about or one that you've always heard about and kind of, you know, dreamed of. We've had Vegas Cecilia on for the real collectors that know that one. So we tend to rotate the themes, but they're almost all Thursday night, 5 o'clock Pacific, 8 o'clock Eastern. And we're pretty much doing every Thursday now, not always continual, but you can go to benchmarkwine.com. There's a link right there for Raid Your Cellar. You can see the old shows because they're all recorded, but you can get your name on the list to be notified of the new ones. And if you just sign up for the general mailing list, you'll be notified of them too. Yes, they're free. Some of them, if you'd like to actually have your face on, we ask a small donation for the charity that we're supporting. If you'd like to ask live questions as opposed to chat, but all that money goes to charity. We're doing it to stay connected to everybody and help highlight some of the wineries, the sommeliers, that are suffering right now. So it's quite popular.
Yes, it is. And I am a regular attendee of it. I love them. It's always educational, and it's not highfalutin, you know. It's like everybody is talking to each other, and it's just laid back and enjoyable and very informative. And then they always provide you in the chat with the list of the wines that they're drinking, so they make us all jealous.
Well, we also try to make the wines available ahead of time. Yes. So if you wanna buy them, we'll deliver them. We sell them at a discount for the show, or a very reasonable price for the show, and you can taste them along with the sommeliers. But yeah, the theme was you're essentially sitting at a kitchen table with a sommelier, and everyone's got a wine, and they're all talking about it. Yeah. Or now you're sitting at the kitchen table of the winemaker in his house, and he's pouring the wine for you.
Excellent. Well, David, thank you so much for joining me today and sharing all this incredible information. I know that collection is kind of a nervous topic for many people. They want to do it, but they're afraid to get into it. And I think a lot of the information that you provided today is going to make that road a lot smoother for them. And I personally can highly recommend Benchmark. I do buy wines from Benchmark, and I, like I said, I'm a regular attendee at the Raid Your Cellars, and I have not had any issues with any of the wines that I've had. They've always come perfectly, you know, shipped perfectly to me. The confirmation process, the tracking numbers, all of that is always, you know, you get all of that, so you know when it's coming. And the customer service, if you have a question, the answers come back wonderfully. So I want to thank you for being on the show, but I also want to thank you for being my place to go to for wine also. So thank you.
Well, Lori, thank you so much for having me on. It's great to have you as a friend and a customer. And thank you for you know what you're doing here. And I hope you have time to visit Raid Your Cellar here in 45 minutes.
Yeah, I'm going to go take my dog for a really quick walk through the raindrops, and then I will probably jump on in. Okay. So thank you. Have a wonderful night. And can we do a little, you were reading my mind. So slancha. Slancha.
Cheers.
Irish coffee. This has been another episode of Exploring the Wine Glass. Thanks for listening. If you have suggestions on what topics you would like me to discuss, please reach out on social media. You can find me on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook as Exploring the Wine Glass. I'm also on LinkedIn as Lori Hoidbud. Of course, you can always email me at exploringthewineglass@gmail.com. If you enjoyed what you heard, please rate, review, and subscribe to help others find me more easily. And most importantly, tell your wine-loving friends, because if you like the podcast, they will too. Music, Wine by Kevens. Until next week, slancha.